from Boca Raton, Florida, this is Behind the Bima. On this episode, the rabbis are joined by Malcolm Hohnlein, Executive Vice Chairman of the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations. Malcolm discusses how he got his start in activism, what keeps him grounded, and how people can make a difference today in the fight against Jew hatred. Plus, preparing to make a bar mitzvah during the pandemic. And the rabbis share Thanksgiving memories and what they're thankful for this year. All this and more, Behind the Bima.
Wow.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and a good Erev Thanksgiving to all. It's Wednesday night, 9 p.m., joined as always by Rabbi Philip Moskowitz and Rabbi Josh Brody, my dear friends. And we have a very special guest tonight, very excited to bring him on. And in this Thanksgiving week, very thankful to him for making that time to join us. But before we welcome him, how are you gentlemen doing? Tell me about your week.
That was yours.
I know, it was great. I can tell you something really special. A lot of simchas have been pushed off, and we got a call just a few weeks ago that someone who's not part of our community, but part of the outreach world that we're working in, and they said, you know, we're looking at having a big wedding, and every week it just got smaller and smaller until we said, you know what, let's just do it at the synagogue. Let's do it at BRS. So we needed a minion. We got a minion. We got Shimi Kamenetsky. We called out all of our friends. We made this couple a beautiful wedding on Sunday morning. It was beautiful.
That's really amazing.
Yeah.
In COVID. That's fantastic. These simchas and particularly outreach weddings and the ability to be connected to Jewish continuity and to the future and the building of the Jewish people. It's a really remarkable and beautiful thing. So much to be grateful for and thankful for, even this 2020 that's been filled with a lot of misery.
Yeah.
Well, it's funny because I'm going through now what you went through over the summer when you were on Behind the Beam and describing, you were writing articles about what it was like to plan a simcha during COVID. So I'm feeling the effects of that now a little bit, and it's definitely different. And it's all about the perspective. It really is. It's about appreciating what you have and what's there, and not about looking at what's not there. And that's the challenge of our times, is to focus on the good.
How the plans coming?
Mm-hmm. Plans are coming along, Baruch Hashem. We're making our mitzvah for my son next Shabbos, for those who didn't hear. Very exciting, my bechor, my only boy. And it's great. You know what? Again, it's really just about shifting perspective. Obviously, there's so much we wish that could be there, and so much family that we wish could come in, and so many things that aren't going to be. But, you know, at the end of the day, everyone's in good health, thank God. And you just make the best of it. And you just you know, you recognize a bar mitzvah for what it is, and you appreciate the brachos.
I know that when we made our simcha this summer, similarly, like you're describing, you could look at how differently and how short it falls from everything you dreamt of or envisioned, or you could look compared to the worst periods of time during this pandemic and say, you know what, if you can convene it all, you're leaning. Like, how many kids had their bar mitzvah only on Zoom? There was no one. There was no minion indoor, outdoor, in shul, at home. Right. So, you know, and it's easy for us to say, for your son Moshe, for you, for those who've struggled, it's okay to be frustrated. It's all right. Nobody should tell you this is Hashem's design, this way it's meant to be. You should be thrilled and not want it any other way. You're entitled to dream and have wanted it another way. But at the same time, be grateful for what it is compared to how small or diminished, even more so, it could have been.
No, you're 100% right. And we talk about that all the time. You know, I really, really, my heart goes out to those boys that prepared hard and couldn't come to shul and lane for the community. Because I don't think, you know, if you haven't made a bar mitzvah recently, and again, I'm only going through this now, boys prepare really hard for it. I mean, the amount of preparation, my son started last Sukkot. It's been almost a year and change that every single Sunday he's been preparing for his bar mitzvah, putting in a lot of hard work. And it's a big deal, you know, for a kid who's into it and really embracing the whole experience. It's a big deal. And again, as I said, the ability to come to shul, to lane in front of other people, that's an enormous blessing.
Now, Rabbi Moskowitz, does Moshe have a website? Where can people get gifts for the bar mitzvah boy?
I was waiting that. He does not have a website. He does not
Moshe
have a website.
MosheMoskowitz.com.
AtaraandKalev.com.
I wasn't going there.
I think their registry has been completed, but it's not too late. Well, I want to transition because we have a phenomenal guest tonight, and it's really so grateful, Tim, for joining us. So special. Before we even bring him on, of course, I want to thank and acknowledge our sponsors for tonight. Helene and Morris Tepper and Leah and Uri Mond, our dear friends and members. In memory of the parents and grandparents, Chana Bas Yaakov Yehuda and Tzvi Ben Chaim Nochem HaKohen, thanks for choosing this venue. And hopefully it's an inspiring conversation, which serves to elevate their neshamas. So a big thank you to the Teppers and the Mons for your generosity. Malcolm Hohnlein is, you know, there are artists, there are celebrities, there are athletes that all you have to say is their first name and everybody knows who you're talking about. And in the Jewish world, but it's really, it's a mistake to say in the Jewish world. I'd say in the world of politics and power, in the world that makes the world go round, all you have to say is the name Malcolm, and everybody knows who you're talking about. You're talking about Malcolm Hohenlein. Now, I was going to refer to him as Mr. Hohenlein tonight, and then I investigated his bio a little bit more, only to learn that while he has a BA from Temple University, he does have a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania. So he is Dr. Hohenlein tonight. And even while he was at college, he already got involved in Jewish leadership and advocacy. He founded the North American Jewish Student Network and has been involved in countless causes until he was chosen as a successor from the first person who was the head of the Conference of Presidents. He's taught international relations, and he served as a special envoy. And you know, the biography goes on and on. That's not why you're tuning in tonight. You know who he is, and that's why you're here to hear him. All the boards around the world that he sits on. He's a power broker. He's the who's who. He has relationships with prime ministers and with presidents who all turn to him for his guidance and for his wisdom. And the fact that he's willing to share it with us tonight, we're really grateful to go behind the Bima with him.
Before you bring him on, I just want to say something about his name. Like you said, is it doctor? Is it mister? I got a text message this morning from someone that went on the March of the Living with us back in 2016. And he says, we went to, on Friday night, we're in Poland. And he said, we went to the Nuzik Synagogue. And I'll tell you another story about what happened maybe later, if we have time for another part of this story. But there was this one place where some of the adults could go and sit down in the corner. So he goes and sits down, and he's sitting next to this guy. And he says, you know, I'm Barry. I'm from Boca. He says, what's your name? He says, I'm Malcolm. I'm Malcolm. Oh, Malcolm who? Malcolm Hohenlein. You're Malcolm Hohenlein. That's the, you know, and you're just sitting there, and just not doctor, not mister, not the president of the conference. Malcolm,
I actually think it's among the most impressive parts, and we'll get into it with him a little bit momentarily. I want to bring him on, but I think that's part of his genius and his greatness is not needing to be the loudest person in the room or having the spotlight on him on the room. I think that's why it works. There's so many other people who need that platform, that audience. They need everyone to cheer them or pat them on the back. He's not in it for that reason, and I think that is the secret to a lot of his diplomacy and his success. But we'll be able to ask him as soon as Rabbi Moskowitz shares what he wants to.
No, I was just going to say, you know, usually and sometimes, you know, like a company's name and the CEO follows the name of the company. But here, I would imagine if you ask the average person what the Conference of Presidents does, most people would not have a great understanding of it. But when you say the name Malcolm Hohenlein, they understand the role that he plays for the Jewish people. So in many regards, he even transcends the position, the name of the organization, and very much defines it in many ways.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We have a wonderful audience listening live, and we know we have countless who listen afterwards. But if you're listening on any of the platforms right now, please feel free to share your comments, your questions, what you want to hear about. And without any further ado, it is a great pleasure to be able to welcome Dr. Malcolm Hohenlein. Thank you so much for being with us this evening. Can you hear us? Are we connected?
Thank you.
And Ben Shapiro over there.
I think we are struggling a drop. Hold on, we'll get him back. I think we're having some internet connections in New York. That's why everyone's moving to Florida.
Exactly.
Now I can do it come the first.
Hold on. We're gonna try to remove and add it back in again. While we're getting that worked out,
you can see you got him right here. There you go.
Well, you know, you saw this article that grandparents were sending cutouts of themselves to their grandkids. Did you guys see that article?
Yes, I did.
If there's anything that defines COVID, then grandparents sending life-size cutouts of themselves to their grandkids for Thanksgiving. That captures the sadness,
you know, we're actually doing
to be together.
For Thanksgiving, I know we'll talk about this a little bit later, but while Rabbi Goldberg's just working over here, we're doing a Friday night live with Sinai residences, Thanksgiving dessert on Zoom. So everyone who's alone, we're going to get together. We're going to compare desserts. Who's got a That's better right. one?
Okay. We're going to bring it.
You're doing this Thursday night or Friday afternoon?
Thursday at 7 p.m. and Friday, but Thursday night special.
You know, for the Jewish world, we encountered the impact of Corona on celebrating a holiday. We encountered it with Pesach, we encountered it with Shavuos, and we encountered it, of course, in a big way with Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur, Sukkot. Yeah. For the non-Jewish world or the non-observant world, this is their first holiday that Corona has impacted. I mean, I guess July 4th, if you want to count July 4th, but really Thanksgiving. Tomorrow's the only day Publix is closed. Tomorrow is the day that people act as if it's a yuntif for them. But hold on, let's see if we have him back. Okay, do we have a good connection now?
Can you hear me?
We can hear you, but coming in and out a little bit. I don't know if maybe with your phone using the cell service instead of the Wi-Fi. I don't know if you can hear us. All right, we're going to still work on this technology glitch. Hold on. Let's try this way.
Cell phone better?
Yes.
Okay, there we go. That is much better. Hold on. That is much better. It is our great honor and privilege to welcome Dr. Malcolm Honlein. Thank you for coming behind the BEMA with us this evening. We're so grateful for your spending some time on this era of Thanksgiving with us. And as we shared in our introduction and in welcoming you, you know, I saw one article that did a profile on you. And I just want to read a couple sentences in welcoming and introducing you and asking that first question. It says, behind the scenes in Washington and Jerusalem in the power circles of the organized Jewish world, Honlein, usually referred to simply as Malcolm, is the face of American Jewry. Prime ministers call him, so do from time to time presidents. Ambassadors wait patiently to meet with him. Hillary Clinton, the U.S. senator, attended his daughter's wedding. So did Rush Limbaugh. Billionaires like Ronald Lauder and Morton Zuckerman rely on him as an advisor. In more than 40 years of quasi-public Jewish service, and this was, I think, 10 years ago, starting in Soviet Jewry movement and more, Honlein has built the greatest Rolodex in the world. We'll have to explain to our young people what a Rolodex is. But there is no question that is accurate. And at the risk of flexing a little bit myself, I had the great honor of being at the White House, not at the signing of the accords, but earlier when Prime Minister Netanyahu flew in and the president announced the peace initiative and what he was hoping for it. I'm not even sure why I was invited. There weren't a lot of rabbis there, but I was there. And I was watching carefully, Dr. Honlein, because I noticed something in that room. I noticed that almost everybody, from Ivanka and Jared to the ambassador of the UAE who attended that event, and at that time it was very prospectively exciting, almost everyone came over to Malcolm Honlein to say hello. Whoever you were and whatever role you serve, everybody had to come through Malcolm Honlein. And I saw firsthand that Rolodex in action and that leadership. So we're very grateful to you for all that you've done for the Jewish people, for Israel, and especially for spending some time with us tonight.
Thank you.
Can you hear?
I said before, I don't know if it was heard, that you could go on with these introductions. I'm really enjoying it very much. But, I do remember seeing you there, and it's not so much who I was, but where I sat that they all had to come by me. You know?
I see. That's the secret.
It's all about
making sure you got the right seat.
Position, so location. You know?
That's lesson number one. I hope everybody's taking notes tonight because you're learning from the expert.
Masterclass.
So I want to get us started, masterclass, with the first question, which is, what are your sources of inspiration? From a young age, you got involved in activism and leadership, and you stood out. So who inspired that in you? Is it parents? Is it grandparents? Is there a role model? Is there someone that you look to in Jewish history, in modern Jewish history, who you said, that's who I want to be? I know people like me look to you. And William Daroff is an amazing person. But I will say, when people ask me, are you ever going to leave Boca Raton Synagogue? Is there any job that you would go to? I have kind of said quietly, there's only one job I would want in the world. And I wasn't invited to apply, but I don't hold that grudge. But I'm curious, you know, you're our inspiration. Who was your inspiration? Who did you turn to for inspiration in getting involved in an activist life?
Well, I have to say my grandparents were inspiration. My parents, Aleichem Shalom, were inspirations. My grandparents were killed in the Shoah, and the Holocaust was a major influence on me and in the choices that I made. And my parents, who were survivors, I won't go through their stories now, but they were very complicated and miracle stories in all cases, that they were able to survive and to get to America and decided to build Jewish lives. It was not a rational decision of Bechart of Chaim at that time, after all that they saw and what they had gone through. But I would say that the Shoah was a motivating factor, because at a very young age, 10 years old, I started getting involved in political campaigns because I realized that Jews could no longer just live at the sufferance of others, as tolerant of society as we may live in. If Jews don't control their own fate, if it's always the subject of others, then we will never be able to safeguard this and future generations. So I got very involved. And on a religious side, I would say Shimshon Raphael Hirsch was a major influence. The Torah Midrash Haaretz approach, which my parents practiced and which I tried to aspire to. I can't say that I'm really very good at it, but I certainly aspire to it. Punktlichkeit is not one of the things I inherited, meaning punctuality, but the ideology and the philosophy. And I had a unique opportunity of having Rabbeim and others who sought me out early. Lubav Jerebin was a singular influence. So were many others over the years and continue till today. And there were inspirational people like Senator Scoop Jackson, with whom I was very close, and others who also helped guide me and influenced my life and involved me in many ways. And the Soviet Jewry movement was a bridge. I got into it very early as a teenager and started, as you said, the Philadelphia Union of Jewish Students, the North America Union of Jewish Students. I was vice president of the Zionist movement and many other. I won't go through all of the list of things, but I did my doctorate at Penn in international relations and Middle East affairs because I wanted to have the best credentials possible to be able to do the things that I wanted, which was to affect the fate of the Jewish people and the state of Israel. And early on, and if you ask me the single influence and direction, I have to just say that it was all Bashar, it was all HaKadosh Baruch Hu. I never looked for a job in my life. Everything happened to me, it was all in this direction, and many unique things happened. I traveled in the Arab world when I was 20. I finished my master's and my bachelor's and was doing my doctorate at Penn at a very young age and learning and doing other things at the same time. But it was all my heart. I'm telling you honestly, I wish I could take credit and say I did it. But it's all things that happened to me. And it was true when I got called to come to New York to start the Soviet Jewry movement or a conference in New York or even earlier, the student struggle. Or when they recreated the JCRC in New York, and I was invited to be the first and I founding executive director there and had been offered the job to be head of the UJA Federation on the very day that my predecessor at the conference died. You can't get more Bashar than that. And I won't, all the details will have to be in the book, but I tell you honestly that it was a calling and sometimes you can miss it, but Baruch Hashem, I answered the right numbers.
That's an amazing story, and I did see that story about the timing of that. I'm kind of curious. You were on this trajectory of Jewish leadership and activism, and you just described that you knew you wanted to dedicate your life to it. Had that opportunity at the Conference of Presidents not arisen when it did, where do you think you'd see yourself now? What position would you have had? Would you work in the UJA Federation world? Do you think you would have entered politics? And a corollary of that, rabbis, we just pack in a bunch of questions into one, but what would you say to a young person today who wants to follow those footsteps, who says, I want to change the Jewish world, I want to be involved in activism? What trajectory or what professional path could they pursue today?
So I have to remember all the questions, but I'll try. First, about the young people, I think that there are great opportunities. There will be great opportunities for people who show that they are truly committed. The one thing I tell young people is you can learn everything. You can learn all the skills, how to do digital, how to do, how to organize, but you can't teach passion. You don't care if it's not in your kishkas. I still work 18-hour days, and I still am involved in a wide variety of endeavors on Israel. I'm still vice chairman of the conference, as you said, and many other things, because I believe it, and it gives me the best sipukan nefesh, the greatest satisfaction. I mean, I couldn't have been a 9-to-5 executive. I had many offers on Wall Street and other places over the years. I had offers for congressional seats. But I knew that my soul and heart were really in this and that my primary concern is the Jewish people and the state of Israel, the future of both American Jewry, world Jewry, the fight against anti-Semitism now, and has been over the years, that the rescue of Ethiopian Jews and Syrian Jews and Iranian Jews and Iraqi Jews and the world we had, the opportunity, the schus, we had to be part of that. There's no greater reward. There's nobody who can show me a fortune that they have made that is of greater significance. And God forbid, when they die, that's over. They can't take it with them. This will remain forever. So young people, you don't know how rewarding, how satisfying, whether you choose to go into Rabbanus, to education, to chinuch, to go into Jewish communal work. It may not make as much money, but believe me, the long-term reward and the satisfaction is greater than anything you can imagine. If I hadn't taken the job, I would have. I already had gone through the whole process to become head of the executive of the UJA Federation of New York, which is the biggest Jewish philanthropy. And this opportunity arose, and they asked me to hold off on the one job till at least I went through the whole process and they had the interviews. And while one job paid three times what the other did and had 100 times the staff, it was my young son who finally sat me down after I literally was going crazy because I had the Prime Minister of Israel, Bob Chereb, everybody weighed in, said, take this job, take that job. And he said to me, well, what is going to give you the greatest satisfaction? Where can you do the most good? Because that's all you care about. You're never going to do it for money. You're not going to do it for the public. You got it. And I said, you know what? That's it. And I made the decision to go with the conference. I don't know. I might have ended up in a congressional seat or something of that kind, or maybe ambassadorship. But there's only one that would be of interest, I would admit, to, as ambassador to Miami. But or Boca, but no, obviously Jerusalem. But I really believe that God. I've been in the conference now 35 years. I came to New York for 2 years from Philadelphia to start the Silver Dream. That was my commitment. And now 50 years later, I've had, you know, a storied opportunities and a career. I'm just starting to look through some of my stuff now and things you don't even think about. I mean, because it was every day, every hour, something. So I didn't have time to compile it and to look through it and to examine it. And, you know, it's such a privilege. I honestly see it as a privilege. And I have a contract with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And as long as I live up to my end, he's lived up to his. And I'm afraid if I put down my guard and say, you know, I'm going to start taking it easy, he'll say, okay, you did a good job, but it's over now. So I'm not giving it up.
We need you. We can't afford for you to retire. You mentioned the people that weighed in when you were considering the position. Before you came on, we spoke about your, or when you came on, we spoke about your Rolodex, the best in the world. You probably have in your phone the ability to call more people at the highest levels than anyone we know. How, as a person committed to Torah, a person grounded in Torah, how did you avoid all of these years that going to your head? You know, you've remained humble and modest, and you've stayed focused not on you but on the cause. You take what you do seriously, you're not yourself too seriously. How do you have those relationships? How do you get invited to the White House for these conversations? How are you at the table with prime ministers, diplomats, and you avoid that getting to your head, that when you come home, you're a husband, you're a father, you're a Zayda, you're an Opa, that you remain the same humble person? What keeps you anchored? What have you done? What are some of the tools that you've used to keep you anchored through the years?
No Opa, Saba. But Saba, okay. Even though my heritage Opa would have been probably, but Saba. Look, I think I tried never to lose the sense of reality by myself and to get caught up in how others see me, but how I saw myself. And, you know, it's not an act I put on. I really see it. I know the truth. And I try to focus on that. That each of us is here for a limited period of time, and each of us is given opportunities. And when you're blessed with the kind of things I've received, then you know it humbles you because you're the recipient, and you have to see yourself in that light. And I never had a PR agent. I never had a PR firm working for me because I wanted people to know us for what we do and not what we say we do. Too many organizations were at that time mimeograph machines, which nobody knows now, but were just Twitter accounts and, you know, Facebook accounts today, where they put out stories, but there's no tachlis behind it. I would rather people say, God, you did so much. How did you do all those things? Your involvements, you know, now in the Gulf, we started 10 years ago. We started 10 years ago building the Mediterranean Initiative, which is, thank God, really taken off between Greece, Israel, Cyprus, and now other countries. When I first went to Qatar 20 years ago, people said, you're crazy, and some people criticized us. When I reached out to Christian evangelicals and started to separate between those, and I led the first fight and created the first task force of missionaries and cults to fight Jews for Jesus and other groups. I also did the first outreach to Kufi, to Pastor Hagee, to people to build relationship with those who made clear where they drew the line and would not engage in proselytization of Jews, but truly had caring about Israel. And criticized often for some of those things until people came around and ultimately realized, you know, what was the right way to go and the right decision. So I think that if you're rooted in our Mesorah and if you have the heritage and you know your place, and ultimately daily and who you're going to stand before ultimately, that keeps you humble because, you know, we all make mistakes. We all do things that we can regret later. So shouldn't be too boastful. And that's why I really don't believe we should be investing money in PR except where it serves a purpose, where you have to get a message out, but that we should let our deeds speak for us.
Dr. Holmlein, I want to thank you so much.
If I can answer one other part, and that is the relationship with the leaders and with every president, Democrat or Republican, since Jimmy Carter, even before, it's because you build a relationship of trust. That's the key with them, that they know you're not going to leak. You're not there to make it, get a headline. I could have gotten them many, many times. I know the most intimate secrets of many presidents because they knew that they could trust us. And they could talk to us and to me to and know it wasn't going to leak. So when young people are looking for this, don't look at the momentary gain. You have to look at it in the long term and building relationship of trust as you do with your congregants, as the congregants do with you. It's true in the world of politics as well.
Thank That's you. Amazing. Dr. Holmlein, thank you so much for being with us. You mentioned passion as one of the driving forces of success. And so many people that I hear speak talk about the Soviet Jewry movement as really the catalyst for their involvement in the Jewish community. And I think one of the challenges that young people feel nowadays is they don't have that passionate thing that they rally around that drives them the way that Soviet Jewry may have driven us 30, 40 years ago. Rabbi Mervis, the current chief rabbi of Great Britain, famously said that he thinks that apathy amongst the young people is one of the greatest challenges to our generation. So we have a large young audience on the show. People looking for passion, people looking for something that they can get excited about and find that they can make an impact on it. Where would you direct them? Someone who feels, you know, in the echo chamber of fame, Facebook and Twitter, so hard to make an impact. How could someone young find that passion within themselves to be that catalyst with the absence of the Soviet Jewry movement nowadays to make a difference the way you have over the last 50 plus years?
It's a great question. And Rabbi Mervis, with all credit to him, was not the first to say that. Moshe Rabbeinu taught us that in the midst of Hakel, that the greatest danger to the Jewish people are not external enemies or natural disasters or wars. It's apathy, indifference, and ignorance. Those were the challenges throughout our history. If we did not overcome, we were doomed. And today we see a generation that is largely ignorant. They're even ignorant. They don't know what the Soviet Jewry movement is. The latest polls, studies show that young people today don't know what Auschwitz was, what the Holocaust was. It's, I mean, it is only 80 years, and some of the last survivors are still alive, and yet we see the Holocaust revisionism, et cetera. So education is the most important thing that we start with. And the changes that we've studied in the studies we've done of young people, it's not that they turn so much against, they turn towards indifference. But indifference for us is a loss. If somebody's indifferent in an election, they just discount themselves. They don't vote for or against. They're just not part of the equation. But that's not true when it comes to support for Israel or in the other fights that we are engaged in. Part of our problem is our success. We saved Syrian Jews. We saved Ethiopian Jews. We saved Russian Jews. And those were causes that could mobilize people. It was pure. I mean, for many, I told often Russian Jews, they saved more of our kids than we did of theirs. That so many young people came back to the community, were motivated by the examples and by the effort. And that is why I am trying now and have been pushing for years and finally seeing results to create a movement again, not an organization, not where everybody's name is and whose, you know, letterhead it's going to be on, but a movement against Jew hatred, against anti-Semitism, which should be called Jew hatred because nobody knows. Anti-Semitism is an antiseptic term invented to diminish Jew hatred and to mobilize all the resources that if young people want to get involved, it is the fight of our day here in America, along with our struggle for Israel, which includes, you know, mobilizing against Iran. And when necessary, demonstrating, you know, I led the efforts on the Iran 13. And Baruch Hashem, it showed that even the worst regime in the world, when we mobilized and made the demonstrations, for the first time since the revolution, the Jews were saved. Three of them were marked for death and 10 for long prison terms. All are home with their families because of it. And I negotiated with Zarif, who's now the foreign minister. And, you know, you could tell when they were lying if his lips were moving. It was very difficult. But it shows that when Jews are united and we stand together against even the worst enemies, against Russia, against, you know, communist Russia at the time, and against Syria, negotiating with Assad for release of the Jews, it shows that when we're together, and this means we need every single person. You may not think that you can do something, but everybody can do something. You can't do everything. Not everybody will do television broadcasts or other things, but everybody can write a letter to a congressman. Everybody can invite them to their synagogues. Everybody can help educate them because they don't know. We assume people have the same level of knowledge about the challenges to Israel, about what Iran represents. But if we do it right and not lecture them, but educate them and share with them the information and what our concerns are, people don't know the degree of anti-Semitism on our campuses. They don't. And I've had, you know, Jewish professors even this week argue with me that it wasn't so bad. And I showed him what the federal government found about his very university. And we know that in Miami we've had problems, in Florida we've had problems at some of the universities, but it's true across the country. And the rise, the doubling of the number of anti-Semitic attacks, the FBI report in the last few days, which is only a fraction of the reality of how many incidents there are. So if young people want to get involved, if communities want to get involved, mobilize today. Make sure every anti-Semitic incident is reported. Make sure the police report it to the FBI. Make sure that we take all those prophylactic measures we can at our institutions. Organize Shmira. Organize, you know, outside of our schools, that volunteers at Everyday Children are there, that there'll be somebody outside, retired people, parents, others, like they do in Europe. We learn from our European brothers and sisters from the successes that they have had in some of their programs. So there are real challenges ahead, and there are positive efforts, building the relationships, fighting BDS, expanding Israel's high-tech reach, helping to bring the message of Israel to more and more people here in this country. They're open to it. By and large, American people support Israel. They want to be with us. Don't be intimidated by the haters. Don't focus on those who have negative messages. Focus on building relationships with every member of Congress who is open to it, who doesn't come with the biases and the hatred and slanted views. That is the vast majority of Republicans and Democrats alike. There's a lot everybody can do, writing letters, getting on Twitter, getting on Facebook with facts, not screaming and not yelling, but give facts so we convince the American people of the justice of our cause and the legitimacy of the case we have.
Just listening to you, your passion is contagious.
Ready to go.
I know.
You talk about mobilizing, and I remember in 2002, you mobilized all of us when you led that rally in Washington for Israel. Rabbi Moskowitz at the time was in diapers, but Rabbi Brody and I were here in Boca, and we actually were tasked with, and I'm proud that we succeeded. Rabbi Brody, do you remember? We chartered a plane.
Planet Airways.
We chartered an entire plane and we flew in for those few hours. We attended that rally. We got in a bus. I think, in fact, it was easier for us to get from Florida to Washington chartering a plane than it was so successful than many who took the bus from New York and New Jersey and got stuck in traffic coming into Washington because that rally was so successful. It was so successful. So you talk about the successes. You talk about mobilizing. As I said, it's contagious and inspiring when you describe it. We all know your successes. I'm sure we don't know the beginning of them, but we know successes. We know those relationships, as you've been talking about, emphasizing. Would you be comfortable sharing what's a regret in your career? What was a failure in your career? Do you regret a particular meeting or conversation? Do you regret not taking advantage of a moment when you had the ear of a president or a prime minister? You could have advocated for something and you didn't. When you look back, I'm sure there's enormous success you're proud of. Are you willing or able to share with us a case of a regret or failure? And I ask that not because I'm looking for you to disclose or shine a spotlight, but I think that too is inspiring to us and to those watching and listening to know that even the people that we see as outstanding successes in life also have things they regret or also have a failure that they have to overcome. That too is part of the story, which is inspiring to us.
Oh, I'm sure there are many regrets. I have to think about a particular one that would be instructive as opposed to just a failure in judgment or, you know, something that occurred. One of the things is that we did not start early enough mobilizing for Iranian Jews, and that every year a couple of Jews were executed until this time, which was the first time we actually found out before they went to trial. So we were able to do something. But I think that in terms of Sobey Jewry, you know, we came into a period where people were not used. Jews didn't go into the streets. Jews didn't mobilize in ways. And, you know, in Philadelphia, where I was living, we organized bigger demonstrations than in New York for Sobey Jewry. And the whole point was that you had to start in some radical way. And we did it in very chutzpahdik ways by taking ads in the papers that a lot of people didn't like because it said 8 great reasons not to march for Soviet Jews. It said, why didn't they come out when my grandparents did? Why didn't they do this? Why didn't they do that? but 50,000 people responded to it. And I can say that there were other occasions when we, you know, couldn't always anticipate what the proper way and had to feel our way through it because it was often uncharted territory. I think in terms of the Soviet Jury, I have regrets that we're going to have a big event in Washington in June, which I've been working on a long time to mobilize all the organizations again into this idea of a movement. And because of Corona, we could not do it. I think that we have not sufficiently educated the American people and the American Jewish community, much of it, about the danger. Ask any student on a campus virtually in every poll that shows now how much they the challenges that they face. And I think we have to do a much better job in locus parentis, getting communities to step in, especially more isolated campuses, but also to raise the standard and to get everybody to adopt the IHRA definition, to get other people so that we have a uniform definition and recognize that this is domestic terrorism and treat it as such, just as we would any other form of terrorism. And there, I think we have not done enough, and we are doing it now. Conference has organized a task force with six different divisions working on everything from security of institutions. And, you know, we started SCAN a number of years ago, the Secure Community Network, which is now working across the country in really remarkable ways. But again, we were late, not because of neglect, but I think we just, people didn't understand and didn't take it seriously. And too many places till today don't. It's a stepchild in the budgets, and I get all the pressures. And the other area, which is not our responsibility, but I feel very strongly, is making sure that every Jewish child has a chance to get a Jewish education. We're losing too many. We're diminishing as much as the Orthodox community thinks that we're strong and we're growing, which we are, but we're still a small percentage of the overall population and can't see the munition that is taking place in other sectors and the loss of so many young people, that we is a collective responsibility of all of us to try and counter that and to make Judaism and the Jewish community and our structure attractive to everybody so that they find their way back to the community. And I think if you look on campuses, the success of Chabad houses is a reflection of that, that when you give them the passion that I talked about and the compassion, and when they ask kids, I think it was at Brandeis and other places, who was the person you had the longest connection to? They said, the Chabad Rebbetzin or the Chabad rabbi, because, you know, Chulit makes a difference. And to have a place Friday night to come and to feel that love and the warmth of it is very significant. And it's a lesson to all of us that those are the kind of things that we have to emphasize to be more open and to be more welcoming and to help bringing back to Yiddishkeit.
Dr. Hohenlein, I've been looking forward to this all day. I'm so excited to actually get a chance to ask you a question. Even before I ask the question, I just want to just tell you, a number of years ago, we were on the March of the Living, and I always have to get all the teenagers to be excited to go to, let's say we're going to the Nozick Synagogue, where we're back in Warsaw. They're not excited. They could easily just daven in a minyan, many minyanim were being held at the hotel. Why do I want to walk all the way to a synagogue? So I try telling them there's a history, you got to see this place. It's not exciting. Then I always go with, you never know who you're going to see. You're going to see someone famous. So sure enough, we're all davening there, and I see that you're standing over there. I said, guys, you have no idea who this is. I said, you know, every single Jewish, major Jewish organization, and they have a head, they have a president. This guy's the president of all of them. So I said at the end, no one's running out to dinner. Everyone started leaving, all the other groups. I said, everyone's going to go over, going to say Shabbat Shalom, good Shabbos, you're going to introduce yourself. And then I'm telling you, I'll never forget this. Every single one of the boys that were online, you asked them, where are they from? What are they planning on doing next year? And they were so moved knowing that you were so interested. And I'll never forget that. But just as an introduction to this question.
I remember.
It was great. But I also work at the Jewish Federation. Not many Orthodox people involved in Jewish federations across the country, and also some of the other big, very large Jewish organizations. As a rabbi, not too many rabbis, Orthodox rabbis working in Jewish federations either. You're someone that's seen all of the major Jewish organizations. You were a proud Orthodox individual. And many of our listeners, most of them are obviously Orthodox Jews. Many of them are not even here in Florida. They're listening all over the country, New York. What would you tell them about the fact that they're not as involved in some of these major Jewish organizations. Would you tell them it's a mistake? Would you tell them, no, it's better to, you know, you keep doing what you're doing? What would you recommend to them?
So I'll reveal a secret. I led the first demonstration against the Federation in Philadelphia for more money for Jewish education when I was in college. And I learned early on that if you really want to make a difference, you have to do it from the inside, not from the outside. And it wasn't a hostile demonstration. It was one to put the emphasis and to, and then we went inside and we met with them. But we led other demonstrations, you know, where and other efforts when the GA, when the students took over, or the WCO, where I was the speaker at the Zionist Congress in Arad, where the students led a rebellion. But it was a rebellion for positive reasons. It wasn't for egos. It wasn't to inject, you know, some crazy ideology. It was to get more attention to the things that we thought were priorities. And I have to say, it worked. And it made a difference. So number one, you got to look at your motivation. You have to look at what means you do it. But we can demonize any institution. But you first should go in and try to change it. And you'll find that people are receptive. Look at the number of yarmulkes at AIPAC today. It's incredible. Now, some could be conservative, it could be other things, but the bulk of them are Orthodox, and many young Orthodox Jews who are today getting involved. I saw at the American Jewish Committee's annual meeting that a much larger number of yarmulkes and kosher food provided, and things that were unthinkable a decade ago are happening. And I see it in many realms. I participated yesterday in a call with senators, and all the participants were representatives of different segments of the Orthodox community. So there is a greater activism. There's a greater involvement. Our schools don't do a job, most of our schools, in educating to involvement and to participation. And so they often, young people often go off in the wrong way because we don't provide the right way for them to do it. I know that we had many debates with Rosh Yeshiva about the Soviet Jewry movement. I even went to see Rabbi Moshe Feinstein about it, who initially was against it because he lived under Stalin and he couldn't see. He told me that, you know, we could make a difference, you'll just jeopardize. And as he saw how we did it and what we did, and I spent time explaining it to him, but he sent a message then to one of our solidarity days. And I can tell you, 200,000 people sat there, stood there quiet. You could hear a pin drop across block after block after block if it was announced. And his son-in-law, Rav Moshe Tendler, read his message on Zamar Adam Reach, and he gave a bracha to everybody who was there. So it was easy to demonize, but I can't tell you how many young Jews tell me that they came back to the community because of the activism on Soviet Jewry or some of the other aspects. You know, Israel's a little bit more complicated because it has political overlays, but I think mobilizing for Israel is still a way. And finding the things that they relate to find something in the smorgasbord of Jewish life, which is a metaphor that I choose, that everybody should be able to identify something they like on that table. And it brings them closer to the community, and it'll bring them closer to God and to their religion and to their faith. And at a time when our enemies have declared war on the Jewish faith, the Jewish nation, the Jewish people, the Jewish past, and the Jewish future, it's a time for us to have to educate them. They know nothing about Jewish history. They don't understand most of the issues that we're dealing with. And frankly, when we studied yeshiva kids and public school Jewish kids, there wasn't a vast difference sometimes in the level of knowledge. So we have to reach in. We have to get people to learn to vote, to be participants, even on basic levels, to understand how they can make a difference. If they feel themselves relevant, if we show that they are important to us. It was the founding of the Young Israel movement, was to show young people, first of all, inside and elsewhere, to make them relevant to the Orthodox community where they would lead services. They got more invested and more involved. And I guarantee that most of them remained religious throughout their lives from that initial period and exposure. So I think that the imperative is for us, educators, rabbis, leaders, to find ways to involve them, to educate them, to make them feel welcome and relevant and empowered. If they feel empowered and know that they can make a difference. One of the things that drives me crazy is when young people say, it is what it is. I tell them, no, it is what you make of it. It is what it is, says I have no influence and the things will just happen. but you can change how things, and we have shown how we can change the course of history in so many cases. And it was many young people who started to be jury, and Ethiopian jury march, Syrian jury. They can have to feel that they can be efficacious.
I want to ask a follow-up to that question. In your position as a Torah observant Jew, as the head of the conference is a diverse place, diverse organizations, diverse alignments and orientations and interests. And some of those, that level of diversity has been challenged by whether J Street deserves a seat at the table and other cases like it. How have you navigated that as a Torah observant Jew, as the head of an organization with such diversity and organizations not always absolutely consistent or aligned with Torah principles or values? And as part of that, do you have a message, or what would you say about what we're seeing now, this increased divisiveness and polarization within the Jewish world, that whether accurate or not, there's this assumption that Orthodox Jews, you know, worship Trump and buy into him hook, line, and sinker, and that's pushing a lot of other Jews away, that association, right or wrong, fair or unfair. In the opposite direction, there's a feeling that certain liberal Jews will support certain parties that may not be as strong for Israel. I'm not saying any of those stereotypes are fair or accurate, but they're promoting the polarization. How do we combat that? And how have you navigated that? I think that's among the most impressive things of your career are not only presidents and prime ministers, but just internally having to deal with the Jewish people. Having to deal with the Jewish people has to be probably harder than any of the peace that you've negotiated everywhere. So how have you done it with that yarmulke on, earning their trust, keeping the conference united together and as one?
So that's the subject of volume two of my biography, but let me try to answer. The reason, and the way I kept them together, is I gave them a common enemy, me, right, that they could all unite across the board to take me on. But I have to say, there were times, there were people who didn't like the idea that a guy with a yarmulke was the one leading discussions with presidents and stuff. But I'm not an ideologue. I don't have ideological leanings. I really believe in Klal Yisrael. I try to see things in a comprehensive way. Obviously, my own background, my beliefs, so, you know, everybody has them and that influences them in certain ways. But I really believe in the Eidan that Klal Yisrael, as Yaakov Avinu told us, you know, hey, asvu v'hikapsu, that it's not enough just to be physically in the same place. We have to be joined together and unite. And the way we did it is to find the nexus where people agreed and then build on that for other areas of concern for people. You know, that if you show that we can deal with issues with respect and first find that common territory and show them that the whole is far greater than the sum of the parts, that what we can achieve together, because no one organization can do it all themselves. I just have to plug it in because my battery is dying and I want to do on the...
No problem. Yeah, thank you for all of your time.
There, so. Yeah, we appreciate it.
Okay. So, you know, we have to show, because the one condition for every great miracle that happened to us, from Har Sinai, where we stood Kishachad Belevachad as one people with one heart, to the rescue of Russian Jews and Iranian Jews and Syrian Jews and Ethiopian Jews, etc., there was only one precondition that HaKadosh Baruch Hu demanded of us, and that was Achdut, Jewish unity. When Jews stood together, like we did at Mount Sinai, and God said, now you're ready to get to Torah. And the same thing is true of all the miracles. It was when we stood together and put aside our differences, not dismissing them. I think we have to recognize that we have, you know, we're an Am and Gahal Goyim, that we are a Goy, Gahal Goyim, as Yaakov said in his brachas, that we're a nation and a community of nations, meaning that amongst ourselves, we know we're united nations, we have wide varieties, but to the outside world, we have to be a Goy, we have to be united and stand together. And when we do, we can overcome the challenges. When we're disunited, the challenges were too great. And that's what motivated me. And I started on my whole career. In fact, I was in umbrella organizations, so be jury, JCRC, President's Conference, and many other of my involvements spanned the spectrum of Jewish life, because I really believe it. And I believe that we have to bring all of those kochos together for our common destiny, for confronting the haters and the challenges. And that goes to the divisiveness in our society today. The challenges from outside, from the left, extreme right, Muslims, minorities, others who are expressing Jew hatred in more and more virulent ways, to the internal divisions that exists within our community, and that we have to recognize that we are hurting each of us, no matter what your point of view. When you hurt Jewish unity, when you divide us, and the community has to hold dividers to account, those who diminish our ability, it doesn't mean that they have to be marching in lockstep. Homogeneity is not unity. Unity means that we respect each other and we come together and work together. We want to uphold certain standards, and we see, I think people will see in the long term, that that is truly the most beneficial way and the most effective way of meeting our challenges and providing for future generations. Because what we do today will determine, especially now, the security of our children, our grandchildren, and their grandchildren. The fight on anti-Semitism today, as we see in Europe, you know, it is now Jews have died, 12 Jews killed or 11 in France. They were killed because they were Jews, thrown out of windows and burnt and terrible things done to them. We've had it in America. Look what happened in Pittsburgh and Poway and other places, and the hundreds and hundreds, thousands of incidents each year now in the United States. So we have to recreate, and Soviet Jewry did that. It was a movement that said, wherever you're coming from, so that even people on the far left, the socialists and people who were formerly communists, joined in the effort and came together with the most Orthodox people to say, we have a common responsibility to save those Jews. And the ability to do that comes from educating people to what's at stake, what their stake is, and how they can impact it. The divisiveness in American society, if you look at Europe, sometimes it's easier with distance that we see how the political center has been lost, and the radicalization of politics there is happening here. I spoke about it many years ago, and you know, people didn't want to hear it, but it was the truth. We can see, especially in England, things that happen in the Labour Party, the anti-Semitism. We've seen anti-Semitism in the political realm in America. And the lesson is that you have to stand up against it. You have to take it out completely. You have to excise it. It's a cancer. You can't just try to contain it. You have to destroy it and use all of our means to eradicate hatred and the bigotry and true hatred. So it's only an introduction to the really long answer on this subject, but I believe that ultimately people will come to respect that your motivations, even if they disagree with you. They'll respect some of your conclusions and advice if you have a proven record, and will put aside the things that might otherwise drive them away when they realize that it's in their interest and in our common interest to join together.
I want to thank you, Dr. Malcolm Hohnlein. Wow. You've given so much of your time tonight on Erev Thanksgiving, and it's been so inspiring and instructive. Your message is in many ways counterculture to today. Today is all about promotion and followers and friends and spotlight. It's all tribalism. About being, it's a tribalism. It's about being aggressive and rhetoric and differentiating. And your whole message is finding common ground, not making it about you, making it about the cause. And that is so refreshing. It is so inspiring. It's powerful for all of us as rabbis. It's powerful for all of our listeners. I know that we have hours more conversation we could have. We have questions. Our listeners have been sending questions the whole night. But I want to leave you, first of all, by thanking you, but asking for your help. Every week on our show, we have a Shame on You segment, and we feature somebody who has not been supportive of the Jewish people, of the state of Israel, somebody who's taken a position or who has spoken inappropriately. We call them out. We're very proud that on our show, we highlighted the Spanish River Principle in our backyard, and our listeners responded. They made thousands of phone calls, and it reversed the decision, the Board of Education, and he's out of a job now because he had no room in education. So we're looking, we have a group of people, and correct us and our listeners if we're wrong. There's not a place right now for the people who care to go online and say, here's a very simple place to find the celebrities, the athletes, the politicians, those who've shown loyalty to Jewish people in Israel, and here's a phone number or an email to give them a yashar koach, to thank them, to support them. And here are the celebrities, the athletes, the politicians, the public figures who've done terrible things, and here's where you should voice your against them. And we're going to create this platform, this website that's really easy, user-friendly. People who care go on once a day. Unfortunately, it would be a busy website. Just look at the last couple of weeks with who's the guy from the Food Network. And then you look at Rashida Tlaib. There's no shortage. Every day you'd post somebody else. So I'm hoping we can turn to you for help as we put this together. to be able to make it user-friendly, accessible, and easy for people to show support where it deserves, to protest where we need to protest, to make our voices heard, and to make that difference.
It's very important. It's a good idea. Unfortunately, we have catalogs to give you of suggestions, but we have to be also careful, if I could just warn, that the title of anti-Semite, and I know you didn't say, should be the most powerful accusation we can make. So we have to use it judiciously. When people call presidents of the United States and other people, and it's not justified, it diminishes the term. Just as when people make Holocaust references, it diminishes, in fact, the suffering of the 6 million and, you know, people put their numbers on their arms, Jews, you know, when they were talking about the number of Kokovad and other things that made the references, comparisons, it diminishes the reality of what happened to 6 million Jews who didn't live in freedom, but, and those numbers represented death and torture and horrific conditions. So we have to be, you know, I'll give you an example that Nick Cannon, the television star, made some comments, and through a mutual friend, I was introduced to him. And to be very honest, I've never watched the shows or didn't know really, but my kids make sure that before, you know, I get into these situations, I just ask them and they yell at me and say, what, you don't know who that is? But anyway, this guy is no anti-Semite. He's doing a doctorate in theology. He says whole sentences in Hebrew. You know, after he did what he did, he fasted the whole day of Tisha B'Av. He came to my daughter's house on a Friday night for Shabbat meal for hours and asked questions. You know, it is true that there are influences, let's say, that Black entertainers, several of them, echoing things that Farrakhan or others said. They don't even understand the anti-Semitic implications of it. But this is a guy who, it turns out, his grandfather was a Sephardic rabbi and he had other connections, but he didn't exploit it. He didn't say it when the crisis was on because he said, I didn't want people to think that I'm just throwing this out there as a cover for what I did. What I did was wrong. And he said, I'm doing Juma, which is the word he used. Wow. And he gave a whole list of the things that he's doing, including reading Barry Weiss's book and all the other books on the Holocaust and anti-Semitism. So we have to be careful to make sure that when we call somebody out, which I believe it is important to call out those who are truly engaged, but also to emphasize the people who do good things, as you said. I'd rather, you know, praise them and show the people who go on the limb for us and have done remarkable things and who speak out for us during this time against anti-Semitism, whether it's a university president who has done something unusual, or a political person, or as you said, entertainment people. They are the influencers of the target audiences from the study we did. And I started America's Voices to take football stars, baseball stars, and other sports figures, movie entertainers. We identified who has the biggest influence on young people and sent them to Israel. And when they come back and they say, guys, this is no apartheid state, you got it all wrong, it means more than all of us together speaking about it to Jewish audiences, let alone to non-Jews. So what you're suggesting and saying, calling out and identifying it, but be careful and make sure that we have the right charges. And at the same time, honor those who put themselves out on a limb. You have a Congresswoman, Valerie Murphy from Orlando, whose own personal story is remarkable, but she's a great friend of Israel that doesn't get saluted.
Right.
And isn't noticed. So we want to take somebody. She was a Vietnamese boat child who was saved by the U.S. Navy, and her story in and of itself is remarkable. And she does not have a Jewish constituency, but she is a great friend and supporter of Israel. So it's just a local example, let alone Deutsch and many others who are great guys. We should highlight those people who are standing up on the front lines defending us.
Absolutely. Ted is actually our congressman and a good friend, and is going to be coming on the show with his wife. We're looking forward to that. We'll end by just my sharing this quote on the screen, even, that somebody submitted. When I was first learning about Yiddishkeit, I'd listen to JM in the AM, and he'd frequently have Malcolm Honlein on. I learned so much about Judaism vis-a-vis the world from listening to Malcolm Honlein in the mid-1990s. Thank you. That was true 1990s. It's true today. It's true tonight. Dr. Malcolm Honlein, thank you so, so much. Wishing you a happy Thanksgiving. Wishing you a good Shabbos. Wow. And thank you for
I'm
all that you do
show.
And continue to do. Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for having me. And people can still listen to JM in the AM or the John Batzler Show on WABC.com twice a week, nationwide, to be able to follow 25 years on JM in the AM. So we have a history there.
Absolutely.
Thank you for having me.
Have a great Shabbos. Thank you so much.
Have a great Shabbos.
That was amazing.
I could do that for hours. I know.
What passion. Yeah.
Gee whiz.
Is there, part of you that, is there a part of you that yearns for that passion that everyone we know who is involved in the Soviet Jewry movement exudes, whether it was our dear congregant, Rebbe, colleague, Rabbi Friedman, who used to always speak about how the Soviet Jewry movement was what created his passion, Rabbi Brander, who I know had so much of his introduction to communal involvement through the Soviet Jewry movement, and listening to him still so many years later talk about it as if that was the driving force in his life. There's a part of me that wants that craves a little bit of that. I feel like nowadays young people are struggling to find that cause. Really, it's an apolitical cause that has a distinct goal in mind, and I thought it was really contagious. Actually,
I'm blown away by what he said, and I said it to him already. I don't need to repeat myself. How refreshing it is, because we're living in a world of self promotion, and the more followers, the more friends, the bigger, the more meaningful you are. And he really has established a career by not talking about it, but by doing it. By not hiring a PR firm, but by making a difference. And the way he talked also about being a confidant of presidents, prime ministers, they need to trust you, confide in you. And you know what? We live in this generation of the photo op, right? So somebody passes away or someone makes the news and everyone quickly goes to their camera roll, finds the picture they have where they once accosted that person and puts it, there you go. you and Malcolm Holman.
You can see he wasn't that happy before, you know, for me.
They take that picture and they quickly post it online as if somehow their currency goes up because they once met the person. And you know what he's teaching us is that your currency goes on by being discreet and by being a confidant and by keeping information privileged and by keeping it about the cause and not about you. And that's so refreshing for me.
It's complicated, though. No, of course it's inspiring, it's refreshing, but it's complicated. You and I, we've been in many APAC meetings, for example, where that's one of our, I won't say criticisms, but that's one of our things we wish APAC did a little bit less of, right? We wish APAC would take a little bit more credit for what they do, because when we're making the sale for APAC to our congregants about why you should get involved, and people are like, I don't know, what's APAC doing? So sometimes you do have to be a little public with your successes so that people understand why the movement is so important and really their role in the betterment of the movement.
Yeah, but I guess his point was, you know, APAC may need that as a public, you know, lobbying organization, advocacy organization. I guess his point was that you don't want to compromise or sacrifice the relationship just to get the, you know, the attention for that moment. It's not worth it. And really, it's all about making the difference. It's not about celebrating it publicly, unless, and he said this himself, unless the celebrating it helps advance the cause. And that's such a different metric or rubric through which to measure everything you do. Is it helping the cause? Is it advancing the mission? It's not ever about you. And I really found that inspiring and explained so much of his success. What, each of you, what's the one question you didn't get to ask tonight that you would ask him next time?
Well, my question was, I really just wanted a story. He's encountered so many world leaders, rabbis, political leaders. I wanted to know what's one particular incident that comes to mind that will shock our viewers and listeners.
That's good, Rabbi Brody.
I'm just amazed that he's an Orthodox Jew and he rose to the top. You know, there's not many Orthodox Jews in positions like this. You know, you have federations.
You know, when you asked that question, I grew up in Boston. Barry Schrag was the CEO of the CJP, which is essentially the Federation in Boston. He was an Orthodox Jew, so for me that was normal. Right? It was normal. My father
was involved. Strange, because it's not.
Federation.
I mean, again, there's 150 federations, and you don't see too many Orthodox Jews. It's not only in positions of paid leadership. We're not only talking about the executives. We're talking about the boards, the committees. Think about how many people from our community sit on our local committees. Not that many. And you see someone like him, he would say, just get involved. Find an area that you could be involved in, where you can have some influence and you want to see your positions being talked about. So get involved.
Yeah. You know, I wanted to ask him, does it ever get old to go to the White House or be sitting in the Oval Office? What I really wanted to ask him, and it's on my mind today because I was on a panel earlier today, a conversation among rabbis, about, it's not a flex, I'm just trying to make a point here, about how rabbis are dealing during this corona pandemic with unfair criticism or public criticism by congregants and how you deal with that. So I've asked that same question to many of our guests who are in public positions, from Dr. Len Schleifer, who's running a public biotechnology company, to a federal judge, to great Rabbanim, and here to one of the greatest, if not the greatest communal leader of our time. How do you deal with the criticism? I want to know how are you resilient? How do you avoid it eating away at you? How do you avoid it bringing you down? So we'll have to bring it back for a second time.
A corollary of that, which how do you not get burned out, right? So much of what sucks the life out of religious leaders is politics and the bit, you know, the backstabbing and all the nitty-gritty stuff that takes place at board meetings.
Right.
And to have tolerated that for 50 years.
Right.
How do you keep that enthusiasm, that passion, that optimism going when again, there's so much that gets in the way of that?
I was going to ask him, is it true that Rabbi Ephraim Goldberg was never approached to be the next president?
Pretty sure Rabbi Goldberg announced it.
Because I don't believe you for a second, but I would believe him.
No. I'm clearly not going anywhere, because I want you to know it was an exaggeration. I didn't make it up tonight. When people ask me, like, is there a shul? Is there a Jewish organization? Is there something you'd want? Of course, my heart, and I desperately want to be in Israel. But I've really said to people, there's no job in the world I would want other than Malcolm Holine's job. It's got the greatest job. Now, again, that's like, you know, that's like going to Israel for Sukkot and saying everybody should live in Israel. We only get to see the best and the fun part of his job, not the challenging parts of the job. But given what we see, I've said that's what I'd want. But
1 second, assuming one day you do get that job, let's just play it out for a second. We're still going to have Behind the Bima, right? We're still doing it. Okay, just want to make sure.
There's no question.
Before just think about that Rolodex.
Before we wrap up by talking about Thanksgiving, I want to thank our sponsors again, the Teppers and the Mons, in memory of their parents and grandparents. Thank you for your generous sponsorship, and really appropriate to having Dr. Malcolm Holine on. I want to also mention, though they're not a sponsor, but they're really important and worthwhile to support. There's a beautiful program called Achi613, ACHI613.org, Achi613.org, and they have a Hanukkah sale. It's 90 merchants from Israel that you could buy from. This is not a stucca, don't donate money, but there are things that you're going to be interested or buying anyway. Buy them and help support Israel. Help support places in Israel that don't ordinarily or otherwise get support. Achi613, ACHI613.org is a place that you can
go. Got a scroll on the bottom right now.
And I hope that you'll check that out. Let's wrap it up with a little Thanksgiving. Each of you describe what was Thanksgiving like in your home growing up, and what will it be like for you this year?
So I'll take this because I'm from America, Rabbi Brody, so I actually celebrate Thanksgiving. Go next. Growing up in New England, there was like Kol Nidre, Ne'ilah, and then like right underneath it, but like a close third was Thanksgiving. We used to go to my Bubby and Lady's house every year. There were about 25 of us in the house with 1.5 bathrooms. It was really Labor Day. It was the most magical 3 days, 4 days of the year. I used to look forward to it. I used to count down to it. It's when we all got together. And the highlight was, bringing it full circle behind the Bima, was that each grandchild had to play an instrument at a recital Thanksgiving night. And that's when the clarinet came out for all the aunts, uncles, for my Bubby and my Zadie. And it was a real New England clarinet Thanksgiving with the trimmings and the entire full experience. But it was really one of the most magical times of the year for me and my family.
Wow. So I grew up in Cape Town, and there was no Thanksgiving. Let me tell you, no Thanksgiving in South Africa. So for my whole life, I never had it until we came to America. Even though my mom's American, she didn't bring it over. And we come to America. And I remember I was in JEC, and we just got thrown into this Jewish community. And they're talking about this holiday with the pilgrims, and we're celebrating the pilgrims and the Indians. I thought, are these Jewish pilgrims? These Jewish Indians? What's this big holiday that everyone's talking about? Forget it, Thanksgiving. We didn't even have turkey in South Africa. I don't remember ever seeing turkey as a meal. So only after we got married, Simone introduced it to the family.
And now you have it.
You have it.
No turkey.
So I grew up, my father's parents, in fact, my grandmother's Yahrzeit was today. My father's parents came over from Germany after Kristallnacht. Their store was destroyed and my grandfather was beaten and taken away by the Nazis. It's an amazing story of my grandmother. As I said, today was her Yahrzeit, that with great courage, she went and got him back from the Nazis by going to Gestapo headquarters demanding, and they were able to get over and they came really before, obviously, before the worst. But my mother's side, I'm fourth generation born in New Jersey, which is very unusual. I'm fourth generation born in New Jersey. And when I was a kid, like you, we put on Shabbos clothing and we went to my grandparents in Elizabeth, New Jersey. And Thanksgiving was a yontif. We actually acted out the pilgrims and the Indians.
Yes,
and
bows and arrows.
There was Thanksgiving Torah and games. And like I said, Shabbos clothing. And it was a yontif about everything we have to be grateful for. And I think we should end that way tonight, because we are living in 2020, Tavshin Pei Aleph. It's a difficult year, a challenging year. A lot of people have struggled. And there are a lot of things to be miserable about. Rabbi Moskowitz, you wrote about this week in your article. But yet, at the same time, we can't lose focus on how much there is to be grateful for. So as we close out our broadcast, Season 2, Episode 10 tonight, I would ask you to share with our listeners, what are you grateful for in this 2020 Tavshin Pei Aleph?
I am grateful for many things, but obviously with what's on my mind now, recognizing that not everyone gets to see their son become a bar mitzvah and lane from the Torah, I am enormously grateful that Amir Tzashem, in a week and a half, we will be celebrating a simcha with our family.
Beautiful. Rabbi Brody.
I'm grateful that I got the best family and job in the world.
Amazing. That's short it. And sweet. Bye-bye.
That's it.
Yeah. Yeah, I would say I'm grateful also. I think if you look back on 2020, if you look at some of the progress Israel has made, it's been magnificent. I'm grateful that there's some vaccine hope, which hopefully is a light at the end of this tunnel. I'm grateful also that we made a simcha this past summer and you know, to now have two children that we've walked down to the chuppah and to have my little grandson, though he's still too far away, I want to go see him. And there's so much to be grateful for. I think the truth is, if you woke up this morning, if you're healthy, if you have a roof over your head, if you have some income flowing in, you're far ahead of many or most people. And, you know, we could all look at what's missing, but if we focus on what's there, there's an enormous amount to be grateful for. The Chidush Harim, the great Ger Rebbe, said that we're called Yehudim. We're called, Jews are called Yehudim from the name Yehuda, from the word Hoda'ah. We are to be characterized as a people of gratitude. With all the other qualities and character traits we have, we should be identified. You see a Jew, you should be, oh, they're so grateful. That person's so grateful, they must be Jewish. It's who we should be. It's a challenge, and it's a, ooh, someone just asked, and they're right. Where's the Shame on You segment? Hold on 1 second. I'll leave for a moment. Shame on you. Who are we focusing in our Shame on You segment? Is anyone?
We are shaming an anti-Semitism panel featuring Ilana Omar. That's who we're shaming. Mm. Whoever put that panel together this week.
That panel is embarrassing. That panel is absurd. That panel is an insult. I agree. How about Rashida Tlaib's tweet prejudging a Biden appointment because he's Jewish and making all kinds of stereotypes and assumptions about Blinken because he's Jewish? That is also a shame on you moment. And I think that Malcolm Holmline's point, which my mother was machaving to last week, that we have to be very careful how we throw around that word anti-Semite, is really instructive. It's really important. So our group and this WhatsApp has been blowing up while we're still finishing the show. We have to be very careful what words we use and how we describe. And, you know, there are people who say outrageous things that need to be called to the carpet. Doesn't necessarily make them an anti-Semite. And there's others who deserve that label and that description. And we have to hold them accountable. So hold on 1 second.
Breaking news.
We are an hour and 13 minutes into the show, which means it's time to wrap it up. And that is our breaking news for tonight. So, well, once again, among the many things I'm thankful for, the two of you, having beloved colleagues and dear friends. And I'm grateful that people are finding this show inspiring and entertaining and fun and get a lot of positive feedback on it. And we're grateful to our listeners for that. So thank you. And grateful to our guests. We don't pay anything. They come on to get their message out, and I hope that you learn as much as we do by listening to them. So grateful, so much to be grateful for. Until next week, everyone, stay happy, stay healthy, and stay holy. Have a happy Thanksgiving. Have a wonderful Shabbos.
Thank you for listening to Behind the Bima. If you enjoyed the show, please subscribe, rate, and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll see you next week for another peek behind the Bima.